Many of you will remember, I believe, Jane's last appearance on the program, Jane Montgomery Griffith. She's a Cambridge graduate in classics and award-winning stage and screen actor. She's twice been the visiting fellow in drama at Cambridge University, as well as artistic director of the Cambridge Greek Play. And for some strange reason, she's currently the convener of classical studies at Monash and the acting sub-dean of arts at Monash, and we are Australia's fortunate to have her services. The last time she was on the program, we were chatting about the Greek poet Sappho, who lived around 630 BC, because Sappho was such an interesting character and her poetry still influential after all these years. Jane wrote a one-act stage play about her. Well, as I told you earlier, she's been at it again. She's been wandering around the classic Greek graveyard and has unearthed Hypatia, astronomer, mathematician and philosopher. Welcome back to our little program, Jane.
Good evening, Philip. It's very nice to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Sappho to Hypatia. Why are these two Sheilas so important?
Well, I suppose you could say they bookend the classical world. In terms of famous female figures in the classical world, we start off with Sappho, and Hypatia is the last one, not just the last famous female of the classical world, but you could say the last philosopher, the last major figure in the classical world before the Dark Ages.
And there was about 300 years between them?
Oh, a bit more than that. My maths, it's a shame for me saying this, given I've just written a play about one of the greatest mathematicians of all time, but my maths isn't that good in trying to work it out. But 900 years?
No.
Nine. 1,000?
Oh, hang on, of course. Mind that shows how bad maths. I overlooked the BC AD.
That's it, we're in the ADs here with Hypatia. We're around about the 400s AD.
I'm on drugs, darling. You've got to forgive me. Now of course, as you pointed out, Sappho was a great poet who wrote about love and emotions, and like her contemporaries who wrote about boring things like politics and war. Now, you feel that the timing is right for Hypatia because it is, after all, the International Year of Astronomy.
It is indeed, and Hypatia's turning into something of a pin-up, which is great because it's about time she was reclaimed. I think what's fascinating about the Hypatia story is that it's a bit like buses. She's come along in loads of them at the moment, whereas we've been waiting for Hypatia's before this for a long time. In the last 5 years, there have been about four novels published about Hypatia. Yusuf Zidane has recently won what's the equivalent of the Arabic World's Booker Prize with his novel about her, which is being translated into English under the name Beelzebub. There's a play which has been commissioned by Queensland Theatre Company about her.
And, so I was overstating it a bit when I said that you'd gone alone as a solitary figure into the Greek graveyard.
Well, the producer of this play, Helen Madden, needs to take credit for this because this was an idea that she proposed to me when we were working on Sappho. So this has been about 2 years in the genesis, and I was fascinated, amazed to find that obviously other people have been on the same path too. And I think she's going to make a big hit come December when the big Hollywood blockbuster Agra comes out, where Rachel Weisz is playing Hypatia, which apparently isn't too historically accurate, but who cares about that when you've got a good story?
Mm.
So she's going to be out there this year.
Well, let's talk about this very good story, because she was, as the media release reminds us, one of the first mathematicians of the cosmos and a considerably talented astronomer.
She was. Of course, in this period of the classical world, there wasn't that much differentiation between a mathematician, an astronomer, an astrologer. The Greek science tended to try to encompass all of this, and really it was about the search for truth and trying to find truth through numbers and through astronomy. Hypatia was the daughter of Theon, who was the final great academic of the Academy at Alexandria. And what's interesting about her history in terms of its reception, the way that she's been treated over the millennia, is that up until quite recently, few scholars thought that she could actually really have done the maths you know, women aren't really supposed to be mathematicians, are
they? This is the conspiracy theory that Dad did a lot of the work.
That's it, absolutely. But bit by bit, scholars have started to unravel her genesis and started to think, well, maybe actually she outshone her father. Certainly we know that she worked with Theon on a commentary on Euclid, and this was the commentary that way up until the 20th century was the best-selling textbook of all time. So Galileo, for instance, Newton, they would have read Hypatia's commentary on Euclid. And she was also fascinated, too, in the relationship between astronomy, mathematics and philosophy. We know that she was a Neoplatonist, so she believed in this transcendental entity, the One, and thought that you could achieve God through the intellect rather than through the incarnation, which is why she got into trouble with the Christians.
Why did you get in trouble with the Christians, Jane?
Well, by the time we hit the 4th century AD, the Roman world is very divided, and Alexandria, which had been this beacon of enlightenment, it had been the centre for the intellectual world, the intellectual life of the classical world, had become under the rather dogmatic rule of a couple of patriarchs, Theophilus, and then after him, his nephew, Cyril. And it was a time of great flux. By now, Christianity had become the official religion of Rome and the Roman Empire, and pagans were a little bit problematic. So Alexandria was this extraordinary melting pot where you had Christians and Jews and pagans, Egyptians, Greeks, Romans. It was
To some extent, Jane, it still is. It's always been a most fascinating city.
It's amazing, isn't it, how it's just got such a romance about it, but at the same time so problematic.
Now, I understand that her contributions to science are reputed to include the charting of celestial bodies and the invention of the hydrometer.
Yes. Whether it was the invention or not, we're not quite sure. Certainly it was considered that she had built a hydrometer, and also, so that's something that can measure liquids, also an astrolabe to calculate the size of the heavens. So she was a fascinating character for being able to juggle, if you like, practical astronomy together with very, very esoteric forms of mathematics and this extraordinary philosophy. What's sad, though, is that we don't have anything left in terms of her philosophical writings. Some scholars, in fact, think she might have been a little bit of a, maybe not a groundbreaking philosopher. She followed the Neoplatonism of Plotinus. So perhaps a follower rather than an innovator in terms of philosophy. But for a woman in the 4th century AD to have such an influence in Alexandria was an extraordinary achievement.
Have you got an image of what the city was like in her day?
I did a lot of research about this because this wasn't my period. You know, I was very much a BC woman. And so I spent the last year swatting up on Hypatia. And what I find most fascinating is that every book I've read about Alexandria in this period has different information. The one thing that really comes across consistently is quite what a hotbed it was. Not a melting pot, it had actually gone over the sides. So a time of a very beautiful city, very geometrical, absolutely based around Greek geometry in terms of the way it was constructed, but completely and totally dysfunctional in the way that all of these different factions were fighting at this time. The Christian rulers of the city, in terms of the religious rulers, were very, very anti all the other religious factions, and so the Jews were expelled, the pagans were silenced, the pagan shrines were destroyed. It was a very difficult period to be an out-there female pagan.
And there she is, doing her best to preserve and promote traditional Greek rational thought.
Yes, and still believing it was possible to maintain that through line, despite all the signs around her.
What's her legacy today, do you think? Take your time on this.
I think the legacy is an interesting one, because when Helen Madden first asked me to tackle this, she was a footnote in my classical memory. You know, I remembered her vaguely from undergraduate courses on women in antiquity, but I certainly had no idea of quite what she did, what she achieved. And the big difference with somebody like Sappho, for instance, is that because we have nothing left of her, we really are piecing together all of these fragments from nothing. not like with Sappho, where we actually have words and lines. So the legacy is actually one which is much more about, I think, what she means for us today in terms of the need for tolerance in this crazy world of religious fanaticism.
But we do have this commentary of hers on elements of geometry.
Yes, it's a little bit difficult to know how much she wrote about that, but certainly the through line in terms of the way that Euclid's geometry was transmitted through the Renaissance right up to the 20th century, that I think Hypatia can take some credit for.
And you would argue that The Elements was not just the most important textbook in the history of Western science, but became, in effect, the definitive guide on how to think clearly and reason logically.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, she was at the forefront in this period of trying to, train people to work away from the fudginess of fanatical thought. What was the most interesting about her legacy in terms of the intellectual life of Alexandria was that she was the main educator of all of these terribly influential and aristocratic young Christian men who would come to listen to her lectures, and they managed to find a way of trying to marry her philosophy with their theology. But of course, that ability to draw together the strands of one's faith and one's sense of actually what the world is about is totally against the fundamentalism that the Christian patriarchs at that time were trying to inculcate.
Are there any images of her that survive from antiquity?
Not from antiquity, no. There's a fascinating, probably totally apocryphal story of what happened to poor old Raphael when he was doing the fresco of the School of Athens. You know, that wonderful fresco in the Vatican where all of the philosophers of ancient Greece are sitting around chewing the fat. And the story goes that Raphael took a study of the fresco before he painted it to Pope Julius, who was the rather Machiavellian pope at the time. And Pope Julius was a bit upset about this because he noticed that right in the centre of this picture, there was a woman, this only woman in the picture, staring out at him. So the story goes that Pope Julius says, "Who's that woman?" And Raphael replies, "Well, that's Hypatia, Your Holiness, who is the foremost, most famous student of the School of Athens. She's the scientist, the mathematician, the philosopher." And Pope Julius said, "Get rid of her. Knowledge of her runs counter to our belief." But he stuck her back. What's fascinating is he actually stuck Hypatia back, tucked away on the left side of the School of Athens, peeping out behind Parmenides. She's the only woman, and she's also the only woman, the only figure that is actually looking out of the picture at the onlooker, at the spectators, challenging you to catch her eye.
Now that I've got my tiny mind around the before Christ and after Christ datings, she's around in Alexandria while the library was flourishing?
Well, at the end of the flourishing, to be honest. Of course, the stories about the Alexandrian library are just as confused and confusing as those about Hypatia. Nobody really knows when it was completely destroyed. We have various blips in history with Caesar and then in the 270s of riots. Certainly, she would have been around when there was the Christian destruction of the Temple of Serapeum. And this was it's thought that when the destruction of the Great Library happened around about the 270s, many of the books were saved and were taken into the temple precinct of the god Seraphis, who was an extraordinary god. He kind of was this creation, an Alexandrian creation that brought together Egyptian and Greek gods in this strange syncretism. And in 391, Theophilus, who was the bishop of Alexandria, was allowed to launch an all-out assault on pagan images. So his monks and all of his followers came crashing into the Serapeum. They destroyed all of the images. Now, the jury's out as to whether they also burnt the library there. Some scholars say no, some scholars say yes, but certainly she would have been around at this terrible year.
It's one of the great tragedies of 21st century Alexandria is that so little has survived.
Yes.
You go back to the new library, which has been built allegedly pretty much on the site. It's one of these avant-garde libraries that doesn't have any actual books in it, but it's an astonishing place.
Yes.
And you go downstairs into the quite lovely little museum, but there's so few fragments left. It's not like, it's not like the other end of Egypt where there's truckloads. It's thin pickings.
No, that's right. And of course, what's interesting is the way that perfect geometry of the Ptolemaic city has turned into this, bit of a mess, frankly. I mean, it's still got some romance to it, but you certainly don't have any of the perfect geometry of that city.
Let's go back to the pagan question, because that can also be spoken of as atheism, and at a time when the church is establishing its hold over that crumbling Roman Empire. I understand that about the same era, mathematicians were in decline because there'd been a rise of, astrology and numerologists and other nonsenses.
Though it was a bad time to be an astrologer, I have to say. The Roman penalty for being an astrologer at this time was to have your skin torn off with hot tongs.
I beg your pardon? Really?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. They were pretty gruesome, the Romans. So you want to keep quiet about that. No zodiacs going
Dear. Now, why is she done to death by Christian fanatics, given them the mixed feelings and the contradictory signals sent out about her?
It's thought that it was really a power tussle. There was a new prefect who was seemingly quite an open man called Orestes, who had been brought in to look after Alexandria at the same time that Cyril, the young new bishop, had just taken control. And it's thought that Cyril wasn't too happy that Orestes wasn't going to be tame, that he spent a lot of time actually talking to Hypatia. Of course, there are all the rumours that Hypatia and Orestes were actually having an affair. At the same time, of course, the thing that has really flowed through the history of Hypatia was her celibacy, her virginity. So I think that was probably a bit of trying to blacken her name. But Cyril and Orestes got into a lot of political arguments, and there were some nasty shenanigans with some Jewish members of a theatre who got one of Cyril's favourite blokes to be tortured to death. And it was all a very nasty period. What we think is that Cyril had a little chat to some of his higher-up followers. We have a name, Peter the Reader.
Peter the Reader.
Yeah, he wasn't a very nice bloke, though, if what they say he did, he actually did do. The story is that Peter and his mob of, whether they be these strange monks who were sort of attendants to the sick or actually just Christians who had followed his lead, they stopped Hypatia's carriage. They dragged her out. They stripped her naked. That was a very common form of humiliation for condemned criminals. So they stripped her and they dragged her through Alexandria down the main street. They dragged her up to the most sacred church that they had, which was the Church of St. Michael. And they killed her by scooping her flesh out with oyster shells or tiles. So that's
you should
the story.
See the faces of my colleagues. I'm sorry to laugh, but there's a couple of stricken faces on the other side of the big sheet
nice
of glass. They're
die.
Waving their hands and they don't want to hear anymore.
Though the only good thing is that when I was researching this play, I went to speak to a wonderful anatomist at Monash who took me on a practical. I wanted to know actually how somebody really died, if that was the way they were being done to death. And she told me, and I was very pleased to hear this, that she probably would have drowned in her own blood very quickly.
Well, we take great consolation from that. Jane Montgomery Griffith, that's who I'm talking to, playwright, actor, convener of classical studies at Monash University. And I'm just going to slip something in here. I hadn't realised that amongst your many quite arcane credits, you played the hologram in the cult series The Red Dwarf.
How is it that always comes back to haunt me?
Well, not very few of us have ever played a hologram in anything.
Yeah, well, it's my claim to fame, and the number of times I've walked into lecture theatres or seminars and seen some witty undergraduate has actually found that DVD and it's playing.
I was very bad
with a very bad Russian accent.
Was her memory honoured in the years after this terrible death?
For a while, yes, but even that shows some of the tussles that were going on in the Christian movement at that period. Her story is first told by a fellow called Socrates Scholasticus, and there she is held up as being this wonderful figure, this beautiful incarnation of virginal wisdom, who was done to death, and it was all about politics and power. But then just a little while later, we get John of Nicaea, who's saying that she was a whore and she was a witch, and how fantastic they killed her because it was a way of ridding the city of the evil of heresy. So in terms of actually practically what happened, the quite clearly it was hugely contentious. Orestes, the prefect, disappears. He just goes from Alexandria. He sees the writing on the wall and he runs. And to our knowledge, nobody was ever prosecuted, nobody was ever condemned for her death. This appalling mob attack, which potentially was anything up to 200 people setting on this poor woman, it was left unavenged.
When I was talking to you about Sappho, I was almost embarrassed to raise the issue of sexuality, but there is speculation about hers, although she kept herself remote and removed from it. But what's the view on Hypatia's sexuality? I understand she was apparently quite beautiful, as well as being devotedly celibate.
Very beautiful, yes, and devotedly celibate. And for her, as a Neoplatonist, the body was something which was merely a shell. And it was simply a material, dull substance which could be transcended through thought. In fact, there's a story that when a student fell in love with her, she tried to demonstrate the baseness of the materiality of the body by throwing her sanitary towel in his face, saying, you know, this is what you love, young man. You
Is that one of the scenes in your play?
Well, it pops in, but we don't enact it.
Well, it beats Dame Edna tossing gladdies, I'll tell you that. Most provocative. Now, what is your take on the play? Clearly, you're concerned about a woman dealing with fundamentalism.
Yes. This has been, I have to say, it's been a very tricky nut to crack, this play. With Sappho, of course, we have the fragments. The fragments could be woven in. We could create a story about passion and bring in a contemporary love story. But with this, because we have nothing, it was very tricky. And what I didn't want to do was to try to create a pseudo-historical piece, because it doesn't quite mean anything to me, that. What I have actually done instead is create a monologue about a contemporary woman, a contemporary mathematician, if you like, who is trying to deal with her own life by relating to this exemplum of everything that she cannot be, you know, this perfect figure, this wonderful, saintly, brilliant, celibate mathematician, which is a complete... It throws in the face the contemporary woman's failures to live up to her standards. But by the end of the play, they've managed to find some sort of way of connecting. And I think what has come across most strongly through working on the play is the pain, the ongoing pain of looking around the world and thinking, why are people still doing this to each other in the name of religion?
Mm. Why indeed? Now, of course, the church wanted to destroy all memory of her and that of her work, but she's forever present within the Vatican with that Raphael fresco, isn't she?
That's right, just staring out and challenging us.
The only woman in the company of Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, etc.
That's right.
But didn't Pope Julius want to paint it out?
Well, yes, that is the story. That is the story that he was that Raphael was told to excise her. But I do like the story that he popped her back in. There is another story too, though, that the model for Hypatia was in fact Raphael's lover, which makes it even more piquant. So I'm quite keen on that story. Probably totally spurious, but it makes me smile.
I was sort of being slightly ironic about you wandering the world and finding yourself at Monash, but it's been fortuitous because one of the great experts, if not the expert on Hypatia, is a maths lecturer at Monash.
That's right, Michael Deacon, and I owe him a great debt of gratitude because his work on Hypatia has been really quite groundbreaking, bringing together not only the way that she's been received through history, but also a really interesting analysis of her mathematics. So it's been, I have to say, an absolute joy to be able to tap on the knowledge of colleagues at Monash, not just Michael Deacon, but also colleagues in mathematics. mathematics and in astronomy, and not to mention the anatomy department. So it's been a great place, actually, for writing this play.
Raising Hypatia, R-A-Z-I-N-G, a pun?
Anything for a cheap gag. Yes, I'm afraid it is. But also, I suppose in a way it is an attempt to raise the ghost of her and to try to exorcise some of the demons which have been around her image, either because she's too perfect or because she has been obliterated from memory. And to try to find a different sort of truth in the connection with her. I think when the big blockbuster Agora comes out, we'll see a rip-roaring and quite moving story, but it will be trying to follow perhaps not a particularly historical through line. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in actually the connection, I suppose.
It is argued, and it seems to have some merit, that she was the last great scientist, woman scientist, until Madame Curie. Look, thanks for coming on again, Jane Montgomery.
It's been a pleasure, Philip. Thank you.
Do pop back in a few years when you've unearthed someone else from the Greek graveyard. Jane's written a one-act play on the ancient Greek mathematician, astronomer and philosopher Hypatia, Raising Hypatia, opens at the Alliance Francaise Theatre in Melbourne on August the 20th. And yes, we will put details up on our web page. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to play you a little bit of music while we prepare for the end of the world. As I warned you, the program tonight ends in mushroom clouds.